This is Passing Judgment, a podcast about the law and how it affects you. I'm your host, Loyola Law School professor Jessica Levinson. Think of me as your personal law professor as we navigate the big legal questions of the day with some of the biggest newsmakers. Hey, everybody, it's Jessica. There's been so much talk about Trump's, quote, big, beautiful bill that we wanted to talk to somebody about what's actually in this bill and who is going to be impacted if it passes. So we're talking to Richard Rubin. He's the U.S. tax policy reporter for the Wall Street Journal in Washington. He focuses on the intersection of taxes, legislation, politics, and economics. He was also the lead author on the journal's coverage of the 2017 tax law, and now writes frequently about the challenges facing the Internal Revenue Service. He really helped me understand what is actually in this bill, which groups would be most impacted, again, if it passes, and what's the horizon really for the short term, the medium term, and the long term. So I hope you enjoy this conversation. As always, please rate, review, and subscribe. With that, Richard, who better to help us understand what is going on with this big tax bill than you? I know you have been covering it very closely, and your reporting has been extremely helpful for me. I just want to thank you for being here and for helping us dive in and understand exactly what's going on.
Yeah, happy to be here.
So, Richard, I think I want to start with exactly what is in the GOP tax bill. I know you have a recent article. I think the subject was something like breaking down what's in the tax bill. There's a lot of proposed tax cuts, new spending. I know people have heard about potential reductions to Medicaid and to SNAP. Could you take us all the way from the beginning, assuming that we really have just heard that there's a tax bill pending? And could you give us that heavy lift of telling us what is in the bill? What should we be focused on?
Yeah. So I'm going to break it into four buckets for you, which is tax cuts, tax increases, spending cuts, and spending increases.
Because this bill has buckets. Let's do it.
We'll do the buckets. And so when we do this, we won't get to everything in the bill. It's more than 1,000 pages. So I'm going to miss something. Okay. Tax cuts. Most of the money in the bill is going toward extending the 2017 tax cuts that are scheduled to lapse at the end of this year. If Congress does nothing, these tax cuts go away. So that's things like the standard deduction would shrink, marginal tax rates on individuals would go up, estate taxes would go up, taxes on closely held businesses would go up. Most people, 60-some% of people, would experience a tax increase. Congress wants to avoid that. Republicans want to avoid that in particular. And so they extend those. That's the largest chunk of the tax cuts. And they extend those permanently. Then there's some new tax cuts that come in. An even higher standard deduction and child tax credit, which kick in tax year 2025 and is temporary through 28. And that's really designed to put money in pockets right away. People will feel it in the refunds they get in 2026. Then there's versions of the no tax on tips, no tax on overtime, no tax on Social Security, also taking effect this year. Also, people will feel those. So that's kind of the core of what most of the tax cuts are. Tax increases. They roll back a lot of, this is the House passed bill, which may change in the Senate. The House rolls back a lot of the clean energy tax credits that Democrats created in 2022. So it says, you know, it phases them out. Wind, solar, geothermal, all that kind of stuff. Okay, so and then there's some other scattered tax increases. There's a new itemized deduction limit for very high income households, which is kind of a fun thing that they put in there, and some other odds and ends. Spending cuts, right? Medicaid and SNAP are the two largest areas where that's happening. Medicaid, it's got more frequent eligibility checks. It's got work requirements for able-bodied people, a bunch of formula changes, and then other rules sort of discourage Medicaid and states from covering people who are here illegally. And then spending increases is the last bucket. And that's really two big areas. One is border security. So it's got money for ICE. It's got money for Homeland Security. And the other big bucket is national defense. So there's a $100 billion or more. So I don't have the exact number in front of me of of money that goes to the military and defense. And so when you think about all those things together, someone asked me like last week, like, what is the theme of the bill? And the theme of the bill is Trump and 218 House votes. And this is something that it's really designed. All those buckets are calibrated to fulfill the president's priorities and get it over the finish line in the House and then ultimately the Senate.
I want to focus on that, fulfill the president's priorities. And when we look at the budget in particular, it seems like there's a lot here that looks like it's fairly typical of a Republican administration and a Republican-controlled House, in the sense of, I think people listening are accustomed to this particular administration doing things that other administrations have not in other areas. We can point to all the executive orders. We can point to an escalation between the administration and higher education and all the changes in immigration. And I think what I'm trying to ask is, this particular bill, and again, obviously it's not final, it's still pending, but is this, in your view, as somebody who has covered this for a number of years, is this a fairly typical GOP proposal? Or are there things in here that look different from what we might have seen from George W. Bush, or if he were ever President Mitt Romney? Or is this more aggressive, for instance?
I think it's different in some respects. So in here, look, there are tax cuts for the rich. Like, let's not, like, and they're largely in the form of extending and in some cases slightly expanding the 2017 tax cuts. So we're not going to like say that that high income people are not getting tax cut. Compared with doing nothing, they are. But capital gains taxes, you know, capital gains dividend tax cut, long a Republican priority for many Republicans, not in this bill. The corporate rate, Trump has wanted, you know, down to 15%. There are some businesses would obviously love that. Corporate tax rate doesn't get touched in this bill. You've got the no tax on tips, overtime, bonus for seniors. Those things are their tax cuts, but they're, you know, if you hear Republicans for a long time talk about simplifying the tax code and broadening the tax base and lowering rates, that's not what those things do. There's more complexity. So that's a little bit different. And I think, you know, if you listen to Jason Smith is the Ways and Means Chairman, he's from Southeast Missouri, and he represents a relatively low-income district. And so some benefits that we talk about, standard deduction, child tax credit that he's giving an extra boost to, really do lower income taxes for people, you know, making $40,000 to $60,000 to $80,000 in Southeast Missouri. Now, that's not where like the bulk of the money necessarily in the bill goes, but there are real benefits for that group of people. So that makes it a little different, and they're really focused on that area. I think there's a new account, sort of savings account for young children that's called the Trump account. I mean, it used to be the MAGA account, and they amended it late to call it the Trump account. It's Trumpified in that sense. There are a number of provisions throughout here that are aimed at reducing immigration and going and sort of making sure that people who are here illegally are not on benefits, not getting health insurance through the government. There's a new tax on remittances that's part of this. There's, you know, so you see that sort of Trumpish flavor in that respect through here. So there are some, and there's a new thing that Trump talked about on the campaign trail of providing faster corporate and business write-offs for factories in America. And so, you know, that's sort of his focus on domestic production is reflected in here. So it's a bit of a fusion, I would say. It's not, this is not the Republican tax bill that they wrote in 17. It's different. It's not the Republican tax bill that they would have written under President Romney. It's not exactly like the Bush tax cuts were either. So it's its own flavor. And it really is kind of I think I used the word mishmash in print. So I'll say it here of everything, because what it really is trying to solve for as it came out of the House was what could come out of the House.
So this is, I love this. We're talking about buckets. We're talking about a mishmash. Richard, you helped us understand what's happening in this bill, and they just passed it. We're recording this episode the afternoon of Friday, May 23rd. What helps them to pass it? What do you think helped them pull it across the finish line? Because I know there were some sticking points.
Yeah, look, they made some deals in the end that got some wavering, we think what we call warring wings of the Republican Party on board for it at the end. So there were three key areas that they had to change in the end to make this work, to get it across the finish line. It passed 2:15 to 2:14 at 6:30 something or so in the morning on Thursday after an all-night session. And the three areas they changed were Medicaid. They accelerated the new work requirements in Medicaid from 2029 to December of 2026. That was intended for hardline conservatives who were worried about the tax cuts being front-loaded and the spending cuts being back-loaded. So this now kicks in, just after the election, but before the, a new administration would start. They accelerated the phase out of clean energy tax credits. So those are a much harsher kind of cutoff. And then they also provided a $40,000 cap on the state and local tax deduction instead of the $10,000 current law or the $30,000 that was in the prior version. And that was really designed for a handful of members in New York, New Jersey, and California who were demanding that change for their high-income, highly taxed constituents. And they were willing to vote no, they said, if they didn't get something like that. And so it's an example of those members are the minority of the Republican Party, of the Republican Party in the House, representing Westchester County, New York, and Long Island, and Orange County, California. But the House is now divided 220 to 212. So any four House members can get together, any four House Republicans can get together and say, nope, we're not doing it unless we get our thing. And that's what happened there. And so Speaker Johnson, to his credit, found, with a little help from the president persuading people, found the magic formula that satisfied everybody just enough to get this over.
And this is the SALT tax that you've written about, and the move of saying that the deduction for state and local taxes is now going to be four times the current cap, currently $10,000, now moving this up to $40,000.
Yes, exactly. And this is an issue that has been, it's a bit of a messy issue because, for a lot of people in those high tax areas, they got tax cuts from the 2017 tax law, and the previous effective cap on the state and local tax break looked like zero, but it was sort of opaquely taken away from you. And so with this thing called the alternative minimum tax, which we're not going to get into, but the $10,000 cap was incredibly politically salient. And it's like a thing that people know because people can compare that $10,000 number to their property tax bills and say, I'm getting screwed. And so it became a thing that those members really had to deliver on. Like Democrats also, the issue divides Republicans, right? Because, if you're a Republican from Florida, I talked, take Greg Stubbe from Florida's on the Ways and Means Committee. Like he would rather go to zero because, that's a low tax state. And he sees that the state and local tax deduction as basically a subsidy for New York's higher taxes, because New York can essentially push off some of its state taxes onto federal taxpayers when you get that deduction. So there's a push and pull there, and the issue divides Democrats. Democrats, when they were in full control of the government, were also unable to change the $10,000 because you had some members who wanted, went up to 40, 60, 80,000 is the version that passed the Democratic House. But then you had Democratic senators from, you had Democrats on both sides. You had sort of moderate Democrats like Joe Manchin who didn't like it. And then you have progressives who were like, well, wait a minute, why are we giving a big tax cut to people who are, wealthy enough and high income enough to pay $80,000 in state and local taxes? So it's a messy issue and one that's going to come up in the Senate because as opposed, you've got, this goes to a sort of constitutional structure, right? You've got,
yes,
right? Like Republicans in these high tax states, New York, right? Long Island, Westchester County, New Jersey. But in the Senate, there's basically no Republicans from very high tax states. And so there's nothing like a constituency for it. And so what you've got is a push and pull between senators who don't care about that deduction and would like to reallocate that money elsewhere, and senators very mindful of the fact that significant changes to that $40,000 figure could make the bill untenable in the House.
Well, and I noticed, Richard, that over the past 24 hours, I think two of the articles that you've either written or contributed to have the word loom in it. So we are moving, of course, from the House to the Senate. And I think you just explained one of the big places where we can expect to see movement, which is the SALT deduction. And in terms of what else we can expect. I mean, do we think other than this deduction, I think people listening might really have no sense of what happens next. Will there be, we think, specific sticking points? Is this close to we expect in final form? Obviously, both the Senate and the House divided, you know, not big margins for the Republican Party here. So what can we expect moving forward? As you said, new fights loom in the Senate. Another article, Trump's big, beautiful bill heads to the Senate where new fights loom. Where are we?
Yeah, so the Senate math is like this. There's 53 Republicans and 47 in the Democratic caucus. So they can lose three and still have the vice president break the tie. Rand Paul of Kentucky is basically a no because this bill raises the debt limit by at least $4 trillion and he doesn't want to do that. And he's been very clear about that. Ron Johnson of Wisconsin is very upset about this bill. He thinks it doesn't do nearly enough to lower spending. So he wants a much bigger spending cuts and he wants to break it up into two bills. He's got a whole set of ideas. And so he's at the moment in the no column. So they've got a couple of 50 votes out of the remaining 51 senators, if you think about it that way. And there are senators who've got issues. I think you've got senators like Tom Tillis of North Carolina and Lisa Murkowski of Alaska who are concerned about the clean energy tax credits going away too quickly. You've got senators concerned about Medicaid, and particularly, and that's a very state-focused thing because Medicaid is a federal state program, and so each state kind of handles things differently. So that on that issue, Susan Collins of Maine, Murkowski and Dan Sullivan of Alaska, Josh Hawley of Missouri, all up in the air on the Medicaid side of things. I think there's a number of other areas where senators are senators, and they want to put their stamp on this bill too. So I think there's, you know, some who will have their own ideas that they want in here, that some we know yet, some we don't know yet. And so this is the dance they have. And I think I wouldn't say, so I guess I think about it this way. It's almost certain that something will happen, right? Like there's like the idea that this will all fall apart and the taxes will go up on everybody and the tax cuts expire. Like that's not tenable. So they're trying to find a way. They're mindful of the pressure from the president to finish this by July 4th, or the pressure because the debt limit's included to finish this before that becomes a binding constraint sometime in August. They're mindful of the House margin that they can't, you know, fiddle with it too much, but Senate gonna Senate. So they're gonna make
it. Richard, can you take us to civics class for a second? There's going to be changes. You said the Senate's gonna Senate. What happens after that? So the House passes a bill about 24 hours ago, now maybe 27 hours ago-ish. The Senate's going to make some changes. What happens next?
Right. So everything you learn in civics class is like mostly true.
Imagine I went to a school where I learned interpretive dance, haiku, maybe not the basics of civics here. So what?
Oh, then yeah.
I know.
Like, yeah. And this is a 1,000-page bill. We're not doing haiku right now. I don't know, honestly. Like, it's not at all clear whether the House would then pass its own version and send it back, whether they'd have a formal conference committee, whether they'd kind of negotiate this in advance with the House so that whatever comes out of the Senate has a glide path to get through the House. That's kind of a June question, and we're still in May. The Senate is gone. The House, both chambers are gone for Memorial Day. They'll be back in early June and get cranking on this. And I think some of that will get figured out then. Ultimately, the same exact thing, the same text has to pass both the House and the Senate. And that we're not at that place yet, obviously, right? The Senate is going to make changes. This also gets into some wacky civics class stuff because they're doing this through a procedure called budget reconciliation, which is, normally you would think, oh, the Senate can pass things because if 50 members plus the vice president are in support, they can pass it. But we have the filibuster, so you need 60. Reconciliation is an exception to the filibuster. And so if they stay within the bounds of these rules, it's got to be primarily fiscal. It has to follow the numbers that they set out a couple of months ago. You know, there's all sorts of other little restrictions on budgetary impact. Then they can pass this with a simple Republican majority. And that's really the overriding thing here, because the parties are so polarized right now and Republicans have this rare chance where they have the House, Senate, and White House for the first time since they lost the House in the 2018 election, that they're really motivated to find that formula, that recipe, that way to get a majority in the House, a majority in the Senate, something the president will sign, because this is really their, you know, they call it the one big beautiful bill. It is their one big lonely shot at legislating something significant.
Right. And Richard, this really helped me in terms of both kind of the macro and micro level of what's happening in this bill, what passed the House, the issues that we need to think about for the Senate, and, you know, what is likely to happen after the Senate does, as you said, the Senate will Senate. And I'm hoping that because we did go into some details and you helped walk us through, and we started with those buckets, I'm hoping if maybe we can end with the buckets, but add people to the buckets in the sense of, I think people are not completely sure how, if something close to the bill that just passed the House, not completely sure how it would change their lives. So I think that when you talked about, it was very helpful to think about the first bucket would be just keeping the tax cuts that are already there. So there I see kind of no big change. There would be new tax cuts, as we talked about. There would be a change. And maybe you can, I know you said it before, but kind of remind us and highlight who's going to benefit the most. And then, you know, a rollback of the tax credits, who was benefiting the most from those credits. And then I think in terms of spending cuts, we generally know, you know, who's affected by Medicaid and SNAP the most. These are safety net programs. And then you also talked about spending increases. It sounds to me like that would benefit the most in terms of the defense and Department of Homeland Security. But maybe if we could focus on the new tax cuts and the tax credit, because it seems to me that's where people might feel it the most in their daily lives. But correct me if I'm wrong on that assumption.
Here's how I'm thinking about the impact of it. And you can think about it a bunch of different ways. So we did boxes before, or buckets before. Let's do boxes instead of buckets. So I think about it in three boxes with a fourth box on the side. And so box one is like very high income people. They're going to do just fine, right? They will get their tax cuts extended and some new tax cuts here and there from the bigger SALT deduction, from this deduction for closely held businesses. So people on the high end, and they're not losing much out of this. People at the very bottom, box two, you know, who rely on Medicaid and SNAP are going to face some new hurdles. There's going to be cost sharing for states in SNAP that might cause states to roll back some benefits. There's, you know, these changes to Medicaid, more frequent eligibility checks, those kinds of things. People might, you know, in the official forecast say fewer people would have health insurance. Some of those are probably ineligible now and would get, you know, screened out. Some may be eligible and just run into those hurdles. So I think people at the bottom will you know, lose resources from this bill. And that's what Democrats are highlighting, the difference between those two. The third box is people in the middle. And those middle income people, you know, because of the bigger standard deduction, the bigger child credit, no tax on tips, no tax on overtime, new deduction for seniors, people in the middle will see tax cuts on top of just the extension. And Republicans have made sure that they can show that to people. And so I think they'll see that, you know, there's less of a safety net for them. If they lose a job, there's probably more of a incentive to make more money because the taxes are low if you, you know, move up and you start a business and it does well. And then the fourth box, I think, is sort of off to the side, is people who are like in entities that are disfavored under this administration lose. So clean energy programs lose, immigrants, you know, mostly, you know, illegal immigrants in particular, people who don't have, you know, or don't have citizenship from the various changes in here would lose. There's new taxes on, or higher taxes on, university and foundation endowments, right? We've seen what the administration has been talking about on that. So those kind of, I wouldn't say enemies is overstating it, but there's clear, like, this administration has taken a clear shift against those groups. And I think there are things in this bill that clearly reflect that.
Mm-hmm. I said wrap up, but now I lied. And I do have some follow up here. I think when people hear high income, middle income, everybody has, in my view, a slightly different sense of where they are and what these numbers actually indicate. And obviously, high income in California is quite different than I think high income maybe in a place like Tennessee, where the cost of living is different. So could you give us a little more detail when you say, you know, high income will be fine, the middle will see, keep their cuts and maybe see additional cuts. What are we talking about in terms of a two-family household, for instance?
Okay. Yeah, I don't, it's tricky. I would say, you know, at the top, I'm talking about people with combined incomes, 300,000 and above. In the middle, that middle group that's going to get new tax cuts, probably in the 40 to 80 range, where there's a lot of people. And then, you know, the low income is probably 25 and below, people might, who might have intermittent work or, you know, or not working. That's kind of how I think about it. I don't have the data right, you know, right at my fingertips here, but those are generally how I think about it. And it's, as you know, like, it is different in different places in the country.
Right. And then with all these tax cuts obviously come and more spending in certain areas, it means that less money's coming in and money is obviously going out. And I do want to highlight for a minute, what does this mean for the deficit?
The deficit would get, well, let's think about it this way. The deficit, if you assume all the tax cuts expire, right? If you assume that, like, Congress does nothing, all the tax cuts expire, then compare what this bill does, the deficit would probably grow by about $2.7 trillion over the next decade. And remember, even if Congress does nothing, the deficit is going to be, like, this is difference between revenue and spending over the next decade, about $21 trillion. So this would be a 13% increase, $2.7 trillion on top of that $21 trillion. If you start from a different place and say, okay, well, just assume all the tax cuts are extended, then that's like $3.8 trillion. And then this bill ends up being better for the deficit than, you know, than just a straight extension of the tax cuts, because you've got those clean energy tax credit rollbacks and you've got the spending cuts and those kinds of things in there. It's also a little tricky because, as we talked about, some of those tax cuts are temporary. So, you know, the no tax on tips expires after 2028 under this bill. Well, you know, is the Congress at the end of 2028 really going to let that happen if people are happy with it? Probably not. So that would bump up the deficit impact somewhat. And this is the place where Republicans kind of found their happy medium. There are some lawmakers who would be fine with bigger tax cuts and more deficits, others who, this is kind of the outer limits of where they could get, where they would say, well, we think there's going to be economic growth, and so it won't be as bad as that looks, and it'll be fine. And so this is where they landed. I don't know yet which direction the Senate is headed on that. There are some members who are very concerned about deficits and some who are less so.
Well, I think this is a big stay tuned, but you really helped me to situate myself in terms of what are we looking at, what's happening happened in the House, what might happen in the Senate, and then eventually what could happen to all of us in the sense of, how will this affect our bank accounts? How will this affect our pocketbooks? So, Richard, I know you've been very busy covering this. And
it's been a week.
It's been a week. We'll put that in a box and a bucket at the same time. So thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, thanks for having me.